This is Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. Yesterday, we met a young woman in Denver who's biracial and who wished her family would have talked more about race. At one point when she was really young, April Edwards was so confused, she cut herself to see if there were two colors of skin beneath the surface.
It caused a lot of confusion for me because I didn't know what it meant to be half black. I literally thought that when I looked at myself in the mirror, half of me should be black and the other half is white.
Now April and her family are talking more openly, but it's not easy, says sociologist Dina Samuels of the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She's leading workshops at the History Colorado Center in Denver called How to Talk to Your Kids About Race. It's associated with an exhibit there. Dina, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Do most kids have places to talk about race and, frankly, people to talk about it with?
The short answer to that is no. Especially in white households, race is not talked about at all. In fact, there was a study done that parents were asked to talk about race with their children every night for a week. And the parents were so uncomfortable with the topic and really wanted to be colorblind that after a few days, many of them said, I'm done with the study. I can't even complete the study.
Did they say what made them uncomfortable?
Well, they were brought up to believe that colorblindness is the answer. And unfortunately, it's not. Now we call it actually a covert form of racism.
Colorblindness as a form of racism? How does that work?
Yes.
Explain that.
So colorblindness, basically, I mean, what I always ask my students or participants in a workshop, I always say, out of whose mouth do we hear the words, we're all the same, I don't even see your color? And the answer, of course, is out of white people's mouths.
In a way, then, color blindness is not acknowledging the elephant in the room, the elephant that comes with cultural and historical and social baggage.
That's exactly right. In fact, color blindness ignores not only systemic racism, but it ignores the person in front of you. If you're standing and talking to a person of color and you yourself are white and you say, I don't see your color, you're basically saying, I don't see you. I don't see the struggles you've had. And the person of color, by the way, knows they're not treated the same for the most part. I mean, I'm generalizing here, but for the most part, people of color know that they're not going to be treated the same by police officers, by in their classrooms, in their office places. They know they're not going to be treated the same. So to ignore that is really a slight.
And yet we heard from April Edwards, the young woman who is a mixed race. One of the questions she's tired of answering is, what are you? Right? So why should it matter? I mean, I guess what you're saying is that there should be an acknowledgement, and yet someone like April Edwards is tired of having to respond to the acknowledgement.
Absolutely. And hearing that every moment of every day or, you know, every conversation you have is what we call a microaggression, one of those as Dr. Darryl Wing-Sue calls it, he's out of Columbia, and he talks about microaggressions like paper cuts. And by the 10th time you've heard it that day, you've gotten so many paper cuts, now you're bleeding. And there is actually tons of research that shows that those who are the recipients of microaggressions have all kinds of extra stress that they have to deal with, both emotionally and physically. So much so that there's literally a difference in mortality rates based on those who are exposed to microaggressions all the time or who are the recipients of them and those versus those who aren't. So getting back to your question, this question of colorblindness, what are you? The question is, why are we asking that question? So if it's to check off a box, that's a microaggression. If it's to get to know April better, to see, help me understand who you are and I want to get to know you better and know what your background is, that's a whole different thing. That's connecting.
What does research say about how kids' views on race develop? We heard from April's family, her father, saying, you know, I think racism is taught. Does science back that up? Does research back that up?
Absolutely. I mean, you can see little kids walk around and they'll talk about race as though, you know, it's not a big deal. They don't say the word race. They just, I mean, you if you know Beverly Daniel Tatum's work, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? She talks about, you know, the 4-year-old in the grocery store who looks over and says, you know, oh, why is that? Did that kid or that person drink too much chocolate milk? And that's why their skin is darker than mine. And the parent, of course, immediately goes, hush, 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 you're not supposed to talk about that. So the kid then grows up thinking, this is a bad thing to talk about. And of course, the parent is thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to look like a racist for the fact that my kid is curious. The reality is, it should be okay to do. You don't need to talk about melanin in skin for a four-year-old, although I would talk about melanin with an older child. But you can certainly talk about the differences, the beautiful differences that we have between us.
It's so interesting. What you're saying is that parents think they're doing their children a service by avoiding race.
Yes.
Because they think by avoiding the conversation, you are actually creating a form of acceptance. But they're achieving the opposite.
The exact opposite. In fact, when those kids in that study that I talked about initially, the kids who were given a pre-test and a post-test sort of before and after this experiment, and the kids are absolutely not colorblind. Most people aren't colorblind unless you are medically colorblind. And so to pretend that we're colorblind is really, it's a disservice to this. If we want to challenge racism, this is not the way to do it.
I wonder if the test you're referring to is the one I took before our interview, which is to judge bias, even if it's not explicit. My result, I'm ashamed to say this, was your data suggest a moderate automatic preference for European American compared to African American. It was a tough thing to read.
Yes, but it is critically important to take these tests. This is the implicit association test by Harvard's Project Implicit. And it takes 5-7 minutes to do, and you get immediate results. Basically, what the test does is it lets us know where we are. What's our starting point? If we're starting to think about this stuff on a deeper level and trying to get inside our brains to try to see what have I soaked up? That's really all this test tells you. What have I believed? Which stereotypes have I believed to be true?
Is this a common outcome, the one that I got? Your data suggests
yes.
It is? Okay.
Absolutely.
You can take this test at cprnews.org. We've put a link there.
Excellent.
And so there's a difference between I'm a racist and I have a slight preference, automatic, by the way. It says automatic preference for European American compared to African American. I wonder to use the phrase, this isn't a black and white issue. That is, it's not that you're racist or you're not. It's that you can be someone who considers yourself accepting and have automatic biases. Is that right? Maybe if we saw more gray area, this would be an easier conversation to have. I'm afraid of saying this on the air because I think people are going to think I'm racist, you know?
And you're not alone. People who take this test, and I encourage my students and workshop participants to take it all the time, I don't necessarily ask. I mean, even when my students turn in their results, I don't really look at the results. That's not why we're taking the test. The idea is not to get stuck in, you know, whether you got a slight automatic preference, a moderate automatic preference, or a strong automatic preference. These are automatic. These are pre-conscious. So it's not even that you're thinking these things. It's that these impulses are happening in your brain, and they're sticking. So what we need to do is get them unstuck. And there are ways to do that. And that's the thing that I love about this test and why I encourage so many folks to take it, because there are simple things we can do that actually will challenge those biases, and they can change over time. Mine has changed over time. I took the IAT many years ago, and I've taken it recently, and my results are completely different.
What's an example of how you've changed it?
So one of the things we can do is what John Powell calls priming. For example, if you know you're going to have a meeting with somebody whose group you have a bias against, what you can do right before the meeting is literally think of a counter-stereotypic example of someone from that group. And the studies have shown that your interaction with that person in that meeting will have changed. It takes 2 seconds.
And let me say, when African Americans take this test, they often as well have automatic preferences for, is it European Americans as well compared to members of their
Absolutely.
Own racial group?
Yes. And the reason for that is that we're all exposed to the same messages in this country. The messages have a racist composition to them. Like, that, this is what we're getting. We're bombarded with racist, sexist, heterosexist messages, and they sink in. Even people of color are afraid of people of color, specifically because they're getting these same messages, and that's called internalized oppression. I know that for me, when I started doing this work, I thought, someday I'm going to wake up and none of these ideas are going to be in my head. Like, I will have worked my way so far along that I will all of a sudden not have these thoughts anymore. And I'd wake up and they would still pop into my head. It finally hit me that, oh, every day I'm bombarded with more of these messages. So, of course, I mean, you'd have to be dead in a way to not be exposed to these messages. And so what do we do with those messages? So now, as a critical thinker, when those messages do pop in my head, I'm able to challenge them immediately.
I just want to point out that you are white. And you've said you've said it's okay to talk about race openly. So here I go. You're
absolutely
right. You're white.
Yes.
Do you ever get pushback that you come at this from a privileged point of view?
Mm-hmm. So for me, I mean, when I'm presenting, it's obvious that I'm white. I always talk about the fact that race is a social construct. I am white. I get the benefit of being white. I know that part of the reason I got where I am is my white skin.
Well, let's wrap up with a piece of advice for parents who perhaps have not yet broached the issue of race with their children or their future unborn children. How do you suggest bringing it up? What's a good technique?
So I think that just as with any other really important topic, it's important to take time, whatever they need to do to actually pay attention so that it's not an off-the-cuff comment, but that it's actually a discussion. I think asking the questions about race, how does race affect you as a white kid or as a kid of color? You know, the notion that this is a problem for folks of color is truly letting ourselves off the hook, letting the country off the hook. You know, the fact that I have white privilege and that I benefit from my white skin is at the expense of someone else. Racism affects all of us. And it affects me negatively, not in the same way that it would affect a person of color. But I know that racism, for me personally, what I've learned is that it separates me from other people.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.